I'm not sure I understood all of that. Well, thank you all very much for coming along. And the talk I'm going to be giving today is based on this blog post from about a month or so ago. And in fact, many of the people here have contributed in some way, shape, or form, either sort of before the fact, in the thinking that went into it, or after the fact, telling me how to improve the argument there. And to some extent, some of these ideas will go into a book that I'm writing about the future of science. So thank you very much to all of these people. I'm going to start actually with an example that Chad used early in the week. It's an example I'm very fond of. It concerns... Okay, well, I was kind of curious about that, but anyway, we see the... It came up, which is Hooke's Law, which is something that many of you would have heard about in your high school science classes. It tells you that the restoring force on a spring is proportional to the extension of that spring. And Hooke published this in 1676 as an anagram, which I've shown here, which he revealed 2 years later in 1678 as the Latin utensio sic vis, I think I've got the pronunciation roughly right there, which means as the extension, so the force. And the reason, of course, why he published it as an anagram rather than in the more conventional way is that if someone else made the same discovery in the intervening time, Hooke could reveal the anagram and claim priority without having to share his initial discovery. So it bought him time to make sort of further progress without actually having to reveal any information in the intervening time. Unfortunately, Hooke was not unusual at the time. Many other great scientists engaged in similar, at least sort of dubious practices. So people like Leonardo, Galileo, and Huygens also employed ciphers or anagrams or other methods of obfuscation to try and gain a competitive advantage over their contemporaries. The great Newton-Leibniz controversy occurred in part because Newton claimed to have invented calculus in the 1660s and 1670s, but didn't actually publish his work until 1693. Imagine if the human genome had not been published in it full, but rather had been published as an anagram or had been published 30 years after the fact. Sort of modern biology is I think, really unthinkable. So you know, the obvious question to ask is why were Hooke, Newton, and their contemporaries so secretive? And I mean, the answer is pretty obvious. You know, at least up until this time, discoveries were routinely kept secret. There was a transition going on at this time, which I'll talk about a little bit more. But just I want to point out that before that, you know, you had the very secretive culture of the alchemists working on things like, you know, how to transmute lead into gold and the secret of eternal youth. And very often these people didn't publish at all. Quite often their discoveries, some of them we call scientific discoveries, went with them to their graves. And the reason why is quite clear. The secretive culture of discovery is a very natural consequence of a society in which there was little personal gain for these people in sharing their discoveries. So what happened in the time of Hooke and Newton and a little bit after was, of course, science started to become very successful at this time, and governments and other wealthy patrons started to get interested, and they began subsidizing science as a profession. But there's a very particular aspect of science that they decided to subsidize. It wasn't the making of discoveries, because the making of discoveries is not enough. It was the sharing of discoveries. So the result is a scientific culture which to this day rewards the sharing of discoveries with jobs and prestige for the discoverer. So this transition was just beginning in sort of the end of the 1600s, but you know, a century or so later, the time of Michael Faraday, a little bit more than a century actually, the transition was complete, and he could advise his younger contemporary, William Crookes, the chemist, to work, finish, publish. A scientific discovery by this stage that was not published in a scientific journal was not truly complete. So there's a real major change in the culture of discovery. It took about, I think, probably 120 or so years. So, of course, as you all know, when a scientist applies for a job today, their record of publication is one of the most important pieces of their application for the job. But when Hooke applied to be curator of experiments at the Royal Society in 1662, he certainly wasn't asked for such a record of publications. And the reason why is obvious, and that is that the first scientific journal didn't appear until 1665, 3 years after the fact. So we have this interesting situation. Humanity over the last 350 or so years has constructed this base of shared knowledge, sort of a collective long-term memory for our civilization. So the system has changed surprisingly little in the last 300 years. That's a little bit of a lie, actually. Sort of the first 50 or 100 years, it did change a reasonable amount, but it's been very stable on that sort of time scale. And the internet is now offering us, as we've been hearing, this opportunity to improve this collective long-term memory. But I think there's another sort of parallel opportunity at the same time, which is to create, for the first time in history, a collective short-term working memory, sort of a conversational commons for the rapid collaborative development of ideas. And so these two parallel ideas are things which I will explore. I'll sort of go backwards and forwards between during my talk. So the first sort of parallel exploration, these two separate ways I refer to here, the internet can improve the way we communicate and the way we do science. So the first way, which is the way I think we've mostly been focusing on through this week, is you know, to think about this body of shared knowledge, the journal articles or whatever. And journal articles have only ever been a tiny little part of all the useful knowledge. Harry Collins talked about you know, tacit knowledge, and Michael Polanyi, and certainly this other tacit knowledge is sort of an example of stuff out here that is not necessarily shared knowledge. And what we've seen over the last 10 years, and many of the examples from the last few days, have been a gradual expansion in the range of shared knowledge. So we have things like the physics preprint archive has expanded the range of shared knowledge. In biology, we have services like GenBank, BLAST, and so on, which are very, very widely used. Those examples are very, very successful within their fields. I mean, they're almost universally used within their fields. But alongside those very successful examples, there's also some much less, many, many, many more examples which have been much less successful that remain niche applications, even if a lot of people think that it would be useful to adopt. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One example is JOVE, the so-called Journal of Visualized Experiments. And actually, Moshe Pritzker, who's the CEO of JOVE, tells a story that sounds, it could have been Harry talking the other day. Now, Harry wakes up. He talks about how frustrated he was during his PhD at doing these experiments, day after day after day of work to do the simplest little thing. It doesn't work. He goes and he talks to his colleague in, you know, a campus just up the street, and they say, "Oh, just watch me do it." And he says he's doing exactly the same thing, except some tiny little difference that the person isn't even really aware of. He goes back to his lab. 10 minutes later, he's done. All right, and so Moshe, what he does, what JOVE does, is they send out people with video cameras into labs. They record what is going on. They record experimental procedures, and they put them up online where they can be downloaded. It's they're reifying tacit knowledge, in some sense. Exactly. I don't use the term tacit knowledge, but I really think that's what they're doing. And there's certainly a lot of parallels. So that's JOVE. There are many other examples. So there's open notebook science, as practiced by Jean-Claude Bradley and many others, including a couple of people here. Garrett gave his sort of open notebook examples the other day. Cameron Nalon is another person who's practicing it. We've got a fair fraction of the people in the world doing open notebook science in the room, actually. Possibly they're doing it at the moment. So I think in the coming years, we'll see a proliferation of tools like this, each geared to sharing different types of knowledge. So we're not just going to have papers. We'll have preprints, we'll have data, we'll have video, notebooks, and perhaps other things that I haven't put on this list, this expansion in the range of shared knowledge. But there's a second and more radical way of thinking about the way the internet can change science. And that's by changing the process and scale of creative collaboration, a change which is enabled by social software such as wikis, online forums, and their descendants. And I just want to give you three quick examples, two of which will certainly be familiar to you. They're drawn from outside of science, because that's where the most successful examples to date have been, for reasons which I'll explore later. So the first of them is the Linux operating system. In 1991, we have this young student from Finland, Linus Torvalds, post this note saying, "I'm doing a free operating system, just a hobby, won't be big and professional, for AT clones. Can you help me out?" And he did pretty well. Okay, totally out of the blue. This is a guy completely unknown, and this is the start of Linux. So So it's actually the comp.os.minix. Oh, there it is, comp.os.minix, which is a, it was a news group, so it's Usenet. And Minix was an academic version of Unix, which actually had all kinds of problems. It was never going to be successful for a variety of reasons. So he did something rather like Minix. In fact, I think it incorporated some of the Minix code base. Greg knows about 3,000 times as much about Linux as I do. Take your word for it. Okay, so there's that example. And the other famous example, here's Larry Sanger's initial note announcing Wikipedia. Humor me, go there and add a little article. It will take all of 5 or 10 minutes. This was also rather successful. Keep in mind, Sanger, he was not a famous guy. He was, I think, in the middle of a philosophy PhD and had decided to take a bit of a break and to do some work for this other guy, Jimmy Wales, 2001. The third example is not so well known. 1999, Garry Kasparov, the greatest chess player in the history of the world, played a game of internet chess against the rest of the world. So approximately 75,000 people participated in this game. The huge majority of them were amateurs. They played by deciding that their moves by vote once every 24 hours. There are a variety of coordinating devices. Nobody thought that this was going to be much of a game. Kasparov said, I was not anticipating any particular difficulties. Well, he changed his mind. He did win. It took him 62 moves. Here is what he said. It is the greatest game in the history of chess. The sheer number of ideas, the complexity, and the contribution it has made to chess make it the most important game ever played. Not too bad for a bunch of amateurs. On one of those moves, one in 40 people voting cast a vote for a move that was not just bad, it was illegal. Okay? You know. It was not that. They played very well, and the reasons why I'm not going to go into. I just wanted to give it to you as an example of a new form of collaboration, completely unlike anything that you know you could have seen 20 years ago. Some caveats to that. That's actually why I added the caveat. So very important. Well, there's a story there which is worth going into. It turns out it wasn't just the vote that was important. It was the real-time coordination was incredibly important. And there's a whole lot of stuff about why this succeeded, which was for reasons not anticipated by anybody, I think it was. There was a lot of innovation took place during the game. Okay, so anyway, these are just three examples of the remarkable things that became possible. They're all examples of collaborative media. Collaborative media, this is something that 20 years ago was a niche research area. Now you have organizations like Google with a market cap of $200 billion, but it's basically a collaborative media company. They are spending enormous amounts of money on thousands of very clever people developing new types of collaborative media. It is not just Google. There are hundreds of such companies or thousands of such companies. So because it has become profitable, it's gone from being a niche research area dominated by a few academics to something where thousands or tens of thousands of clever people are trying very different approaches to developing new forms of collaboration. The way I like to think about it is that these collaborative media aim in some sense to scale up conversation. So you get the same kind of real-time, you get the benefits of sort of real-time interaction, which many people have talked about. But at the same time, you start to get some of the benefits of scale. You start to get some of the benefits of people with expertise that not only do you not know, you don't even know that you do not know. So that's a very optimistic story. And it's tempting to focus, when you're thinking about science, optimistically on the possibilities of these collaborative media. That's not what I'm going to do. Instead, I want to start by looking at two failures of science online. So failure number one is really inspired by the Amazon.com reviews, which I'll assume you're all very familiar with. Certainly if I want to buy any expensive technology goods, I'll always check the reviews out first. And so many, many people have thought about doing something similar for science. We've had some examples. In particular, we heard about Nature's trial of open peer review, which allowed scientists to offer open commentary on papers under the open peer review of Nature. Timo talked about earlier in the week. This was not a success, to put it mildly. Here's the final report. A small majority of those authors did participate and receive comments, but typically very few, despite significant web traffic.
actually got huge web traffic and almost no comments. People wanted to read reviews, they didn't want to do anything else. Most comments were not technically substantive. Feedback suggests there is a market reluctance among researchers to offer open comments. That's one example. Actually, I've had many lunchtime conversations with people who have independently suggested ideas like this. So the first time I did that, had such a conversation, was back in 1997. It was with Daniel Gottesman, who was in this building. Daniel built in 1997 and 1998 this website, which aimed to offer a layer of commentary for the preprint server. The reason I have this is because of the Wayback Machine. He discontinued the site in 1998. It was not popular. Physics Comments failed circa 2006. Same idea. Science Advisor, still alive. It's got corporate backing, not doing very well. 1,100 members, 1,000 articles with comments. Right? People want to join these sites. They want to read the reviews, but they don't want to actually contribute anything. And every few months, I have lunch with somebody now, and they say, I hear you're thinking about the internet and science. I have this really great idea. Why don't we build a comment site? I say, that's a very interesting idea. Why don't you tell me more? They haven't even heard of these sites. So, you all know the problem. There are few incentives to contribute. Why would you write a comment when you could be doing something useful, like writing a paper or a grant? There's a second problem, which is perhaps more minor, but I think it's also significant, which is, to be substantive, you need to be able to write occasional negative things, even for papers that you rather like. But there's a strong disincentive to do so when there are anonymous channels of retribution within science. If you write something negative, even very mildly negative about somebody's paper, they may be in a position to anonymously review one of your grants or papers at a later date, and the probability of them taking some sort of retribution doesn't need to be very high at all before you might start to be a little bit nervous about this. Now, something different is going on in popular culture. There are 1,500 reviews of Pokemon products at Amazon, which is more than the total number of reviews at all of those sites combined. People chuckle. Means popular culture is open enough that people publicly write reviews commenting on the merits of Pokemon. In fact, Ava Hampson tells me that that's what she's doing at the moment. But scientific culture is too close for a similar commentary system to flourish. Now, the Pokemon example seems amusing. It's also ludicrous, right? Yeah, we write an enormous number of referee reports, but this is all private knowledge. It does not benefit the community as a whole. Scientists are obsessed with all these papers. They're not obsessed with Pokemon, or people in general. Kids might be obsessed with Pokemon, but they're not people actually writing the reviews. It's the parents who go and write the reviews. So it seems to me that while this is amusing, it also signifies something deeply wrong, in some sense, or a problem in scientific culture. Second example, Wikipedia. Wikipedia's vision statement is, imagine a world in which every single human being can freely share in the sum of all knowledge. That's our commitment. It's wonderful. It's an inspiring sort of statement. It sounds like it was written by a scientist in the late 90s. It was not. In the early days, in fact, virtually no scientists at all were involved. Jimmy Wales' background was he was involved basically with as a web developer for an erotic search engine. Imagine what that means. Larry Sanger had somewhat more academic involvement, but he was still not, you wouldn't call him an academic at that point. And it's the same old story. Why would you be wasting time contributing to Wikipedia when you could spend it on useful things like writing papers and grants? Now, people sometimes object at this point. They say, well, is contributing to Wikipedia really science? And they kind of have a point. It's certainly not if you believe science is only about conventional forms of teaching and outreach and publishing of papers. But if you believe that science is in part about sharing the understanding that we develop with the rest of humanity, well, Wikipedia, it only costs, I think it's like $2 million a year or something at this point to run. A small academic department costs about that much to run. I think it's a better investment on the part of humanity as a whole. Certainly has a much larger impact, and really I think in many ways scientists would have a much larger impact if they were contributing to it. But we don't. In fact, that explains some of the problems with Wikipedia. So these two examples, and there are many more, and some people have talked a little bit about them. Scientists show a strange reluctance to share knowledge that could be useful to others. There's a parallel here, back to the 17th. A century. Back, the people who founded the modern journal system, people like Henry Oldenburg, they were aware of the value of vote in this. Robert Boyle's first publication was to extol the virtues of an open system in which people would share information rather than keeping it hoarded. That was how he started. And so they constructed sort of the most open system they could think of with 17th century media. And the way they did it, the way they got people to get involved, was to subsidize scientists who published their discoveries in those journals. Now, the irony is that it's this same subsidy which led to the adoption, which is now inhibiting the adoption of more effective technologies. There's an analogy I like, it's a very direct analogy that some people don't for political reasons, I'll give it anyway. It's to the corn ethanol subsidy in the United States. So in the early days when that was introduced, many people who were concerned about the environment actually thought this was a very good idea. At that stage, it wasn't really understood that corn ethanol is actually not such a good thing if you care about the environment. As time has gone on, we've come to realize that actually corn ethanol is a very bad idea for the environment, but the subsidy remains in place. And not only, it's not a net neutral thing, it's now a net negative because it's preventing the adoption of other technologies. Exact same situation, in my opinion. Okay, all right, so I think that if we want to take advantage of these new forms of media so the best examples don't remain outside of science but start to actually come into science, we need to get information out of people's heads and labs and out onto the network. And that doesn't just mean papers, it means data, it means their opinions, questions, ideas, folk knowledge and everything else. It all needs to be out on the network. If it's not on the network, in some sense, it can't really do any good. So this sort of extreme openness that I'm advocating doesn't just mean sharing information in papers. It means making it accessible to every single human being in the world, as John Walensky was talking about earlier in the week. It means developing new forms of media for sharing new types of knowledge, like this tacit knowledge in Joe. It means open licensing for creative reuse, so you can take that knowledge and build upon it in unexpected ways. It means making it machine readable so that you can extract information in automated ways. It means having open APIs so that not only do you have these services, let me draw a distinction. If you look at something like Thomson IOSI, the Web of Knowledge, great service in many ways. You cannot build on top of it. If you look at the archive, it has, just in the last year, introduced an API. What that means is that if you're a computer programmer, you can use their data to build services on top of it. And such services are starting to appear. So by having this open sort of services, you can start to build new services. So this extreme openness takes seriously the idea, which was beloved of these founders of science in the 17th century, that others can build upon and extend the work of individual scientists in ways that they themselves would never have conceived. It's just the modern expression of that idea. So how can we achieve such a more open culture? Well, two very obvious, there's an obvious division here. One, we need to build some lab online tools. Second, we need to cause the cultural changes necessary for adoption. I just want to split it up. Point one is so obvious that point two is often overlooked. We saw that in the earlier examples, all these comment systems. It's an interesting thing to talk to the people developing the tools. Often, they're so focused on building good tools that they're not necessarily thinking as hard about how to achieve the necessary cultural change. I do want to make a couple of remarks about the difficulty of building superb online tools. Now, I mean, this is, it's straightforward advice. It's like, if you're a baseball parent calling out to your kid, hit the ball straight. It's good advice, but not much use. but I think, are any baseball parents out in here? It does require, there are a couple of non-obvious things you can say about it. It requires both superb design and a deep understanding of how scientists work. And there's kind of a difficulty in achieving this in that there are very few people who have both talents. When I talk to scientists, they often are unaware of just how difficult it is. Greg has got wide eyes because I'm sure he knows this. But they don't understand just how difficult it is to build something like Google, any successful online tool. I'll just give you one example of something very non-obvious. Google did a lot of research showing that people would prefer to have more results on a page. They didn't want 10 results, they wanted 50 results or 100 results. That sounds kind of obvious. Well, they actually did a trial people hated it. They discovered that, when they moved from 10 results up to 30 results, they decreased hits and ad revenues by 20%. They did this in 2006. They did a lot more work, and they discovered that the reason why is because it took Google 0.4 of a second to return it when they only had 10 hits, and it took them 0.9 of a second to return it in that case. And actually, although people were not consciously aware of the time lag, it was enough to cause this change. That's what they finally fingered as the result, as the cause. I'm just giving one example, but if you read books about human-computer interaction and things like that, there are hundreds of little pieces of law like this. And so you need to have internalized all these things, but it's not enough just to take a person who's internalized all of these things as a third web developer. They also need to understand the culture of science nearly perfectly. And how many people understand both these things? If you are a person with that sort of deep knowledge of science, you're also likely to, it's talking to people who develop these tools within scientific institutions. It's often not exactly looked upon well by the department chair, to put it mildly. Okay, so how can we achieve the cultural change? I don't have particularly good answers, but I'll give you my bad answers for how to achieve the cultural change. There are, I think, two very useful ways of thinking about the problem. One is top-down ways of achieving cultural change. Science is, in some interesting sense, so individual scientists often feel very powerless to cause a change themselves. But in fact, power in science is, to a remarkable extent, concentrated in the hands of a few individuals. If you look at the NIH mandate, but every biologist in the world is now being affected in some sense by the NIH mandate, or they will be in the next few years, depending on what their local funding agencies are doing. Their publishers are being forced to make papers publicly, freely available. Why is this the case? Well, I can tell you that back in the late 80s, Senator Joe Lieberman got somewhat interested in making information publicly available that was being paid for by taxpayers. I'm just picking on Lieberman because he's one of several. But a very small number of people at the end of the day, Lieberman and a few others, are responsible for setting that kind of policy and are responsible for the NIH mandate, which is going to result in some huge fraction of the world's scientific literature becoming freely available in the near future. So you can do it in that kind of top-down way, and that's certainly happening. There are problems with the top-down way. If you screw up, you can really screw up pretty badly. Because things are being imposed in a system-wide way. There's also a bottom-up strategy of building superb tools and then providing metrics of contribution so people can demonstrate that their contribution actually matters. I'm going to give you a concrete example of this in just a minute, which is the most successful example I know. It's not particularly good, but it's the most successful example I know. The benefit of doing this in some sense is that anybody can decide to do this. Brent?
I believe that still requires the top-down centralized change. It's no good having people demonstrating their contribution until you persuade tenure committees or hiring committees that they're going to take it into account. That was identified at Brookhaven in 1999 as the single biggest obstacle.
I'll give you an example.
Please.
Shortly. Immediately. Okay, so and the benefit of doing this is that many different people can attempt it. Most of them will fail, but it only takes a few cases to stick. And they're likely to be tools which are more useful for the obvious reasons. Oh, I should say as well, so many people have identified, there are a lot of dangers and difficulties associated with measurement. So living in this fishbowl culture is potentially not such a good thing.
I don't know if you really consider the two now, but the EQUIP network links to 30,000 scientist sites where the EQUIPs are. We have 1.5 million EQUIPs online searchable like that. 1.5 million in 18 different districts.
Yep.
So I would be considered a two now, but this is bottom 50, 30,000 scientists have put up their reprints for the collective tools.
Sure. Let me get to the examples of the metrics of contribution and I mean it addresses your point and Greg's both, I think. So I'm going to talk about the example of the physics preprint archive. I'm not just going to talk about it. We've heard it's an excellent tool, very widely used. It meets my point one, build superb tools. While the impact on physics was certainly revolutionary, the archive didn't actually require major cultural changes as prerequisites for success. as Paul explained the other day, in some sense it fit into the existing workflow of physicists. Write papers, distribute them as preprints, and then publish them. It was just a very slight change. But there is a larger cultural change which is underway, and which I've seen during my career as a physicist. Science that are moving to preprints as much more as a primary literature. And let me show you sort of, this is one of two sites. There's another site called Sitebase, which does something very similar. I'm going to talk about Spires because it's more well established. It's a site that what it does, it's been running since the early 70s. It's basically aimed at the high energy physics community and cosmology community and a couple of other communities. So what it does is it keeps track of citations both between archive preprints and regular journal articles. And the fact that it does both of these things is absolutely critical. It's a bit like the Thomson Web of Science, but it includes, they decided early on that they would include the preprints. And this fact is just incredibly important. So here you can do a search for an author, you can find out how many times their paper has been cited, and you get all kinds of information. And this is an archive paper. It's been run, as I said, since 1971 by one of the most prestigious institutions in particle physics, SLAC. Their metrics are credible and well accepted by the community, not just because they're SLAC, but also because they've done a good job and they've evangelized and whatnot. And here's the critical point. It's possible to convincingly demonstrate, as a young physicist, that your work is having a high impact without publishing in a conventional peer-reviewed journal. So I've watched this change over the 14 years of my career. As people have more and more, there's often a section there where people list their preprints that didn't actually get accepted as papers, but they also talk about the citation impact of those. And when you sit around in hiring meetings, people sit there with the Slack side up, going through, looking at who was actually doing the citing of these preprints and whatnot. It's because it's a very good tool for measuring the impact. And it happens to include this, what many people call the great literature. So they've done this really completely from the bottom up. And it's only happening very slowly. It's not that physicists have stopped publishing in peer-reviewed journals overnight. They're not even close to that. You can see that they've gradually become more relaxed about publication. It's kind of interesting. I'm actually seeing quite a few physicists are nodding in the audience. Presume not because they're going to sleep. So it's taking a long time, but I think it is happening. There are certainly many things that could derail it, but it is happening. So Garrett's paper last year. Garrett, I mean, has your paper been published anywhere?
No, it was not submitted. Okay. I like having you coming up.
So Grisha Perelman, who proved the Poincaré conjecture, his paper has been cited, his first paper has been cited about 250 times on the archive. He didn't bother submitting it anywhere for publication. These are still outliers to some extent, and that's a paper that would have been accepted, it would have been renowned no matter what, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. In some sense, it's not such a good example. But at a lower level, people can do the same thing. And I certainly know many people who will say, this is true of some of my work, that some of the work I'm proudest of, I just got sick of being rejected from journals. I just leave it on the archive, and I trust that things will sort themselves out in the long run. Okay, so I want to change gear completely here. I want to get back to this sort of collaborative media and talking about what the opportunities are for using collaborative media. I want to talk about this young fellow, Albert Einstein. He worked from 1909 to 1915 on the problem of finding a theory of gravity. A very difficult problem. Certainly, it's the hardest work he did during his career. And in 1912, he reached the conclusion that a new kind of geometry is needed to correctly describe space and time. He certainly was not expecting this at the outset of his investigations, to put it mildly. He knew the sort of standard geometry of the time, but he didn't know anything beyond that, and he got stuck. And he talked to his friend, Marcel Grossmann, who was a mathematician, who informed him that, in fact, exactly the right set of tools that he needed, Riemannian geometry, had already been developed much earlier by mathematicians. Sort of an afternoon's conversation saved Einstein perhaps several years of work. Those of you who've worked through Riemannian geometry know it's not something you want to have to invent from scratch. In fact, it's not something you want to have to go through with the best tutor in the world. you know, it's difficult enough. Most of the time, we as scientists don't have easy access to the expertise required to solve the problems that arise in our research. Chad has a lovely post on his blog where he talks about the difficulty of being an experimental physicist. I didn't copy the quote down, but he talks about the fact that he's a pretty bad plumber, not very good electrician, a pretty terrible mathematician, blah, 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 blah.
Good thing he dresses well.
Indeed.
My dog, I'd be nowhere.
Not to say that Chad is a terrible physicist. I assume that's not what you meant to imply. Just that, you know, the nature of research is such that most of the time you spend, even the most outstanding people, so most of their time, engaged with problems where they're relative amateurs, or they know that there are people out there who know far more than them about the particular little tiny subproblem that they're currently working on today. What's really going on, I think, here is that expert attention, or expertise, is one of the fundamental scarce resources in science. Most of my time, I start working on a problem, I go off in some other direction that leads serendipitously. So I think I'm an expert on that, but I serendipitously end up somewhere else where I'm not particularly expert, and I know there are people out there who could solve problems that take me 3 weeks in 10 minutes. They could just tell me the answer straight up. So I wonder, given this value in expertise, the way we traditionally sort of address it is through sort of the Grossman model. You go and talk to your smart friend and you hope that they can solve you, that they can save you 3 years of work in a 20-minute conversation. Might it be possible to scale up that conversational model and build an online collaboration market, or I think of as a collective working memory for science? Now, this, of course, you know, we're nowhere near that in science, but I think that if you look at the open source software development world, in fact, you see the primitive sort of beginnings of such an approach in open source software. This is a mailing list that I happen to subscribe to. It's run actually by somebody in Toronto developing a tool called EC2 on Rails. It doesn't matter what that does. The point is that you have these really excellent programmers who are just going backwards and forwards with these little one-liner emails very often. And these are not amateurs. These are people who are very, very good trading their expertise and building this tool rather rapidly. Can such a thing be applied in science? So a couple of people have talked about Innocentive this week. I want to show you a little bit more about Innocentive. It's a tool for doing this kind of outsourcing. You find an expert. Find somebody to help you out. The basic idea of Innocentive, it was started as a spin-off of Eli Lilly, and their idea was to see whether or not they could send problems out into the world that they, or there's something like 70 other companies participating, were not actually able to solve. So the first of these problems up here is to identify a biomarker for motor neuron disease. There's a prize of $1 million if you're able to solve it. That's an unusually large prize, I should say. Most of the problems, they're sort of on the $10,000 to $100,000 level. There are 140,000 people are signed up to the site. You should take that with a grain of salt. I'm absolutely dead certain that most of those people they're not active. But there are many of those people are certainly active. There's a hall of fame on the website that shows many of the solvers, and hundreds of these problems have been solved by people. Here's actually pictures of a few of them who've solved multiple prizes. There was a Harvard Business School study a couple of years ago, Karim Makhani and some co-authors, who showed there's a couple of interesting facts. First of all, most problems were solved by people working outside their domain of expertise. So I think this morning is an example of a lawyer. Beth Novick gave an example of a lawyer, but was that right?
Yeah.
He solved the chemistry problem. So this is not the exception, this is the rule. Actually, there are two interesting facts. One is that most people solve problems outside their domain of expertise. I'll explain that in a second. The second interesting fact is that most of the problems which are solved almost straight away. And they give an explanation for why this is the case. It's because the companies, first of all, before they put them up on this site, they try to solve them in-house. So they're big companies, Procter & Gamble, Eli Lilly, etc. They take the chemistry problems, they give them to their in-house chemists, who are pretty darn good, they have a go at it, they fail. well, what you've learned is the chemists are not very good at solving this problem. So they put it out in public, and they have this very large pool of people who look at it, and it may just happen that a lawyer, I hadn't heard that one before, it may just happen that a lawyer takes a look at it and says, I know how to solve that problem. Okay, so I've just given this as an example of sort of outsourcing this type of problem in this kind of way. It's not a very good model for basic research in a whole bunch of ways. Many of you are probably sitting there thinking of ways in which this fails. In particular, you know, there's a lot of IP issues. It's very difficult to put something up on the site. You have to be in one of the 70 companies. It's not scalable as a model for basic research, but it does, I think, indicate that there is some value to this kind of crowdsourcing of science. Let me give you a different example. The example is FriendFeed, which was alluded to today. There are almost certainly some people on FriendFeed at the moment. I should say, by the way, that for pretty much all of the talks, most of the talks this week, there is an extended FriendFeed comment thread, basically giving a rough transcript of the talks, annotations of the talks, URLs associated to the talks, in many cases, 1 to 2,000 words of additional material by people in the room. So this is my so-called FriendFeed. And what it is, it's just all the stuff I put up on the web, in some sense, all aggregated into a single stream. So if I like something on YouTube, or you know, post something to my blog, or to Delicious, or whatever, any of these other services, it shows up in my friend feed. I can subscribe to so-called friends. I do not, in fact, know Barack Obama. I will see, if I go to this other tab, all of my friends' friend feeds all aggregated into one stream. And there are a whole bunch of other cool things that I can do with it. So that's a good way of keeping up with a whole lot of information. It's a good way also of setting up. There's this rooms feature. There is a Science 21 room, which is where a lot of discussion related to this workshop is going on. I've lost my track a little here. So the key point, the point here I wanted to make, and Cameron may talk a little bit about this tomorrow. Are you going to?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll make this quick then. Basic point was that Cameron used FriendFeed. He said, here's a request for assistance. I need some help with some molecular modeling work I'm doing. Somebody picked this up and said, I could help with that. Who was more expert than Cameron, and indeed a collaboration has ensued. And I guess we'll hear more about it. So it's a way of constructing sort of professional communities of people who you trust to a reasonable extent. And in some cases, you can, you know, you can work together in this way. Now, there are also many problems with FriendFeed. It's not going to work as a way of crowdsourcing research in sort of a scalable way. There are many problems with it. You might wonder whether there's maybe a more dedicated way of exchanging questions and ideas. So I want to talk a little bit about problems with that. Oh, actually, first of all, I want to be a little bit more explicit about some of the advantages that can accrue, and then I'll talk a little bit about the problems that I'll finish. So imagine this person, Alice, who has a problem, a question in mind, which Alice would take 4 to 5 weeks to work out. Bob, who she doesn't even know, she's never met somewhere else in the world, could solve the problem in less than a day. So it's the scenario I talked about before. Typically, not the Einstein-Grossman case, typically, if they've never even met before, do they exchange questions and ideas and start working towards solutions? Well, there's many obstacles. One is just the problem of finding the person with the complementary expertise. But even if they could find the person with the complementary expertise in a very easy way, they would not typically actually go through the exchange. And the reason why, it's familiar, you need to take time to build up trust, to build up mutual language, to build up all these kinds of things. So in some sense, there's an opportunity lost for a trade of mutually beneficial information. So this seems very familiar to us as scientists and very natural. But I want to show you in another context, it would seem really bizarre. Imagine you walk into a bookstore. You want to buy a bookstore. You can see my references. Imagine you walk into a shoe store. Yeah. You walk into a shoe store and you want to buy a pair of shoes, right? You want the shoes more than you want the money. The store wants the money more than they want the shoes. And so an exchange ensues.
It's very simple, right? This is not difficult. And you didn't need to, you just needed to go out and find, you know, you can look up in the Yellow Pages or online or whatever to find a bookstore. I got books on the brain. Okay, a shoe store. I should change this example, clearly. And what makes this possible to some extent is that there's a trust infrastructure of laws and enforcement. You know, if, for example, you were not confident in the money, or they were not confident that the money was not counterfeit, it might be a little bit harder to do this. If you were not confident in your ability to take the shoes back, because there are laws about this kind of thing, you might be a little bit, you know, might be a little bit more dubious about doing this. If shoe stores operated like scientists, however, well, you know, you all know the dance, right? You'd sort of walk into the shoe store, you'd say, hi, how's it going? You know, would you like to maybe go up the road with me to the pub? You'd sit there and you'd have a few beers, and after a while you'd say, you know, Alice would say to Bob, the shoe store owner, you know, I just happened to be looking for a pair of shoes. And after a couple more beers, Bob would say, you know, I just happened to have a pair of shoes. Right? And an exchange and an exchange would ensue. Because that's how scientific collaboration tends to work. I mean, I'm caricaturing, but the fact that you're laughing, I think, indicates that you know that this is the way it actually goes on. But we have this trust infrastructure in that case. There are other things as well, which I don't want to minimize, and I may come back to. So the key point, though, is that wealth is created in this case. What economists have known for centuries is that wealth is created when we lower barriers to trade, provided there is a trust infrastructure of laws and enforcement in place. So David Ricardo, you know, did this analysis in 1817. It said that if we concentrate on areas where we have a comparative advantage, you know, the benefit will ensue for all. That's a very beautiful idea, which is analysis I won't go through. But the analysis works equally well for trade in ideas. But unfortunately, we lack in science such a trust infrastructure and the appropriate collaborative media for free, unrestricted trade of questions and ideas. And I think that this is basically, it means that expert attention is very inefficiently allocated in the present system for doing science, and that as we build new systems and new methods for collaborating and for building up this kind of trust infrastructure, will greatly improve the ways in which science is done. The open source community already does such trade of ideas. It's common. The tools are quite primitive. There are many, many things wrong with them. I certainly admit that. But what's going on in that particular case, and what means that the trust is actually there, is that the very act of contribution itself is what is valued. When I talk to another scientist and I contribute an idea to them, it is in some sense out of my control. On an open source forum, when I make a contribution, when I make a commit to the subversion repository, to use the jargon, it is there forever, right? The act of contributing is what is valued. That is the public record. And that's not the case with the current collaborative media in science. I think that distinction is absolutely critical. So thank you all very much for your attention. There's my blog. There's my friend feed, where you'll get links to the Science 21 room. And yeah, thank you.
Okay, plenty of time for questions. Who wants to start shooting? One and then two.
Great, Gary, come back to your very final point. You've almost conflated the act of recording, again, using the open source example, the act of recording and having a date stamp on that with the act of sort of valuing that contribution.
Yep.
Do you want to comment on the distinction between?
Yes, so there is certainly a distinction. Although it depends a little bit on the person. There's a wonderful moment in an interview of Feynman by a historian in which the historian says, talks about the record of Feynman's working notes on paper, and Feynman interrupts to very vociferously say, no, I actually did the work on paper. For him, the record was not so distinct. The mathematician Hardy was also kind of similar. For them, you know, this external record in the real world actually, you know, that was doing the work. So for some people, I think it's very, very narrow. Experimentalists, I mean, as you know, there's also often, you know, the very act of taking the data
and recording the data, you know, that is the, that, you know, it's very hard to tease out what the distinction is between the record and the actual experiment, in the sense of it's not I mean, you're one of the people doing this.
It comes back. It comes back to Greg's point: is that it's all for we need to, and this the point about social culture that you made, that you need not just to record everything and date stamp it, it needs to be tied into that. Yeah. That record needs to be valued, and the things that it represents need to be valued.
Can I add a footnote to that before we go to Chad's question?
Yeah, sure.
There's a brilliant book by Edwin Hutchins called Cognition in the Wild. It talks, and I've seen a couple of heads not talk about exactly these sorts of issues. You know, what point is it the record of the work? What point is it the work itself? How does it transition between those? And what does it tell you about the thought process that's involved? A lot of solid data backing it up. It's not just the
Can I just to finish the response? I'm actually going to respond to Cameron with something that he taught me, I guess, which is that what you want to do, in some sense, is you want to record as close as possible to the actual, to the experiment. You can maybe say better than I, Cameron. You have a nice way of phrasing it, but I'm not quite remembering. Anyway, maybe I shouldn't. Putting you on the spot. Okay.
Well, in the same vein, I would also note that, you know, for experimental work, some of the work and the record of the work is, you know, building stuff.
Yeah.
When I came up for a tenure review, one of the components of it was somebody came in and looked at the lab construction that I had done and said, you know, and wrote a report saying, you know, and this is now a standard part of what we do with tenure reviews for experimental scientists, is somebody comes in. They bring in an external person to look at lab construction, but that's not the question I was originally going to ask.
Yeah, sure.
Which my original thing I was just going to say, I'm not entirely convinced that the failure of a lot of these tools is particularly due to the culture of science, because you see the same sort of thing happen with a lot of other sorts of web initiatives. There's a lot of, you know, for every Facebook, there are three or four failed attempts at
300.
Yeah, at social networking things that, you know, that either didn't get off the ground at all, or there's things like Orkut, which Google launched and is now completely pervasive in Brazil and India, but nobody in the U.S. knows it exists.
Sure.
And so there's some other element here other than just the scientific culture.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah.
There's a paper, by the way, in the rise and fall of Facebook apps and feed-ons and which ones take off and which ones don't. I could send that if anybody cares. Yeah.
So, all right, I'm not actually sure I necessarily understood the question. So.
I'm wondering if you're overstating the importance of the culture of science and subsidies of research and that sort of thing in making things like the science advisor and the various attempts to put a comment system on the archive fail. That I don't think the only thing going on there isn't scientists being, you know, not having an incentive to contribute. There are, you know, other issues that looks very similar to what happens with other.
Sure. What you're saying, I think, is that a lot of these services are perhaps not very good, and you know that can certainly explain an awful lot of failures.
I mean, a lot of the social networking things that have failed are perfectly good, and in some ways better than the things that succeeded.
Yeah.
A couple of points, or question and a point. The first question is, there's something funny about that incentive site where you say if people from different areas, and Beth may even be able to, comment. I mean, how does this square with A, the sort of notion that I have that to be able to do some serious work in an area, you have to be right in the core set of scientists, and B, what Lee Smolin was arguing about, you know, the PhD qualifications to need to get to the front edge of the science. And this sort of problem set, there must be some sort of different kind of problem.
So I think what goes on, I mean, I'll give you two examples. One is a nice statement from Mike Friedman, a Fields Medal winning mathematician. He's commented that, you know, that you are disproportionately likely to make a major contribution to a field in your first, I think it's 10 minutes or half an hour of exposure to the field. Mm-hmm. And it's because very often, you know, people get they get stuck. And actually, the problem which they thought was very hard is really very easy, but they're all coming to the wrong thing. So I'll give you, you know, a very specific example of that is the discovery, the understanding of why the dinosaurs went extinct. And of course, paleontologists were very unhappy at the suggestion that it might have something to do with meteor impact, and there was a lot of resistance to that idea. The problem was solved by a group of people who were not paleontologists. And I think that, that makes it very obvious what's going on there. It's such an easy thing to understand. They were all thinking in paleontological ways about it, what they thought was a paleontological problem, and of course it had nothing to do with paleontology, I mean, except in a sort of very indirect way. So I guess I would, in some sense, I would really disagree. There are a lot of problems where, you know, somebody, you might need to know a lot, but not necessarily about the supposed field at hand.
Well, I mean, you know, does this mean that the amateur theoretical physicist that Dee was referring to, that you get hundreds of letters from every week, really might be onto something?
Well, so I don't think it suggests that at all, because So think carefully about what's going on in the example of the extinction of the dinosaurs. What was happening was that a bunch of people with uncommon expertise, but the right expertise to solve that problem, came in and solved it. Now, that the amateur theoretical physicists presumably actually have, at some level, they don't have uncommon expertise. Maybe they do about other things. Maybe they're great musicians or whatever. But they don't have uncommon expertise which is relevant to the natural world at all. Basically, the argument I'm trying to make, perhaps not entirely convincingly, is that in fact that same kind of expertise. So let's say that they. Let me make it concrete. This makes the argument better. Let's say that they take a little bit of their high school chemistry and realize that they can solve the problem that way, in theoretical physics, for example. But all the theoretical physicists took high school chemistry, and so they should be able to make the same kind of jump.
We've got one more time for one more question, and then I believe we can start drinking. So,
we're actually going to.
So I have to wait.
Maybe some of us will.
This is Canada. Last question, please.
One of the things that I was wondering near the end of your talk, I mean, there are so many questions that one could ask on it, but it's the transition. Trying to visualize how quickly the scientific community adapts to changes in philosophy, not tools, but philosophy that you're suggesting in this presentation. I have my own ideas. I'm sure David probably has his ideas on how quickly the community changes its viewpoint, but I'm wondering how quickly you think.
So I think what is likely to happen, this is my personal guess, Danny Hillis has this great comment that a lot of problems that appear impossible on I think it's 5-year time scales are inevitable on 50-year time, are very easy on 50-year time scales. What I think is reasonably, this is just a guess, there are very strong network effects to the adoption of any of these tools. Once there starts to be some small advantage to a small group of people, that group will rapidly start to expand. And the larger they grow, the faster the expansion will continue to be. You know, Facebook's increase in size is exponential for that reason. So I think, you know, when it's likely to happen, the prediction I would make is it's very hard to say exactly when it will happen, but when it happens, it will be very rapid, the adoption of any of these tools. But the archive was adopted amazingly rapidly. You know, it appeared as a web tool in, I think, 1994, and it existed in earlier forms prior to that. In high-energy physics, I never worked in anything like high-energy physics. I worked in a completely different field, and yet, 18 months later, it was ubiquitous in my field of quantum information. Everybody used it all the time. So it had jumped fields and had achieved near. I never in my career did I regard the journals as a particularly important source of information.
OK. Okay, we're going to have to cut this. Michael, thank you very much.